Welcome to the Human Performance Podcast. Here we talk about everything to do with human performance and how leaders and organizations can get the best out of themselves and their people. I'm your host, Alex Young.
My guest on the podcast this week is Mike Cameron. Mike is a Canadian author, speaker, performance coach, and advocate against gender-based violence. As a sales and leadership authority, Mike has studied the impact that emotion has on human behavior for over two decades. He's designed programs to assist individuals to tap into their emotions in a real and authentic way in order to become exceptional leaders and business people. His 2017 TEDx, The Way Men Think of Strong is Wrong, urges society to help redefine what it means to be a badass. His 2018 CBC op-ed, Dear Men, has been shared over 125,000 times, and his keynotes addressing the importance of emotional intelligence have been heard all across North America. We discuss Mike's life-changing backstory, dealing with traumatic events, and the impact emotion has on human behavior.
Hey, Mike, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Hey, Alex, I am doing fantastic. A little bit warm today, as we discussed, but I'm doing well.
I know. I don't know whether I'm jealous or quite sort of sorry for you being stuck in such heat at the moment. But I know you're doing a running event in a couple of weeks as well. So I'm hoping it cools down for you by then.
Yeah, just a little bit cooler would be nice, but we'll get through.
Well, we really, really appreciate you joining us for the podcast this week, and it's particularly amazing story that you have, and without me sort of spoiling things for the listeners, it'd be great if you could talk a little bit about your own personal journey and what's brought you to what you're doing at the moment.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting because I'm still trying to figure out who I'm going to be when I grow up. I joke about that all the time. I sold my business in December of 2019 that I'd built over the last 16 years with the intention of, one of my passions is speaking, sharing a message from stage. And so the intent when I sold the business was to hit the road and do the speaking circuit. And of course, you can imagine how well that worked out in 2020. I think my last live speaking gig was March 6th. I flew home and then, it was, March 10th or 11th that we were done. And, at that point, everybody just canceled everything because they just didn't know what was going on. So life's been a bit of a journey these last, 16 or 18 months for me. Just trying to figure out sort of where we go from here. As you know, I mean, the world changed and we had to adapt a little bit.
And, the first kind of time I came across you was, I'm obviously a big fan of TED Talks and TEDx and sort of inspirational stories that we often sort of share with our team or with anyone we, work with in terms of partnerships and customers. And your sort of TEDx from a number of years ago now was incredibly inspirational. Could you talk a little bit about, how that kind of came about and what sort of led you into talking about some really quite powerful topics?
Yeah, again, it's fascinating how life takes us down these twists and turns, and often we end up in places that we never, ever thought possible. And that was certainly the case for me. So I've been a sales and leadership student and then teacher for 25 some odd years. And what I recognized very early in my career, I actually started when I was 18 years old, I started my illustrious career literally bagging shit. I bagged steer manure for a garden supply wholesale company as a young, uneducated guy that just needed beer money for the weekend. And eventually I worked my way up through the ranks in the garden supply wholesale company. I became a sales guy. And what I recognized at that point was that my customers, nobody buys a bag of steer manure because they want to own a bag of shit. They ultimately buy that steer manure because they want the feeling they're going to get when they ultimately plant that beautiful rose bush or that vegetable garden or what have you. So I started to recognize that, my customers don't buy the thing. they buy the feeling they believe the thing is going to give them. And, you know, over the next decade or so, I eventually got out of the garden supply business and into finance because it seemed, you know, I played hockey with a guy that was having a lot of fun and making a lot of money doing that. And I thought at 24 years old, yeah, that sounds like something I should be doing. That should be a lot more fun than selling garden supplies. And so I continued to dive into the research behind how we buy on emotion and justify with logic. And so I put in a lot of practices, you know, how do we make that emotional connection with our customer? And eventually I went on, I founded my own business in 2003 and recognized that my staff, my team, their productivity was directly linked to their emotional connection to our purpose and what we did. And the more I could drive that, the more emotional connection I could drive to our purpose, our vision, our mission, the better performance I could get. So again, I'm a guy that likes to understand the why behind the what. So I dove deep into the research. I found a fellow by the name of Antonio Damasio, who's done a lot of work on this subject. And, you know, what I realized is not only do we buy based on emotion, but as human beings, we make decisions based on emotion. And, you know, for me, that was fascinating. And I started getting invited to share my techniques and things on stage because I was successful in business. And so, of course, you know, when you do well, people want to know, well, how do you do that? So I would share that. And, you know, I got pretty good at sort of crafting that message, articulating how to do that, how to influence emotion or make that emotional connection. And it's fascinating to me to think of how this all sort of came full circle. So in 2015, I divorced in 2012. So I really spent, 3 years really just working on self. I found yoga. I found meditation. I was a guy that was hyper connected to productivity. So I worked really hard and I was incredibly successful by all accounts. And so I really, you know, I mean, successful to the extent that it cost me my marriage. So I really started doing the inner work then and looking at how do I move from success to significance. And then in 2015, I met a woman that changed everything for me, like absolutely changed the game. Carissa was an incredible human being. She was a mother, a yogi, an artist, a photographer, a potter, a painter, a videographer. She just had the knack for seeing the beauty in everything. And really that practice of presence that I had so lacked for the last 15 or 20 years, because it was always the next thing. You know, what's the next thing? And so I didn't really learn to enjoy the current thing because I was always looking for the next thing. And so she really taught me patience. She taught me that practice of presence. And then all of that changed on October 2nd of 2015. Carissa and I had spent an incredible night together. It's funny now as I smile, as I reflect. I had just interviewed Bob Berg, the author of The Go-Giver, for my podcast. And so Carissa and I were sitting on the couch talking about the podcast interview. She was reading The Go-Giver. I was reading something else. And at one point, she folds up the book and she leans over. She looks at me with that wry smile, and she says, "Hey, I've got a tip for you on adding value." And of course, if you've read The Go-Giver, chapter one is all about the law of value. And so I stopped and I said, "Oh, what's that?" She said, "Yeah." She said, "When you think I look pretty, you should tell me." I went, "Oh, well, of course, that's easy. You're gorgeous. Like, of course I think you look pretty." And I said, the cheeky side of me kicked in and I said, "How about this? I said, how about when I think you look bad, when I think you look ugly, I'll let you know. Otherwise, you can just assume that I think you look pretty. And of course, you know, she slapped me and we giggled and chuckled. But it prompted this incredible conversation about the importance of actually articulating how we see each other. And, you know, it was one of those conversations that went long into the night, and it was just a beautiful conversation. So we went to sleep. The next morning, she had to teach yoga at 6 o'clock in the morning. So alarm goes off at 5 o'clock. She gets up, comes over to my side of the bed, gets dressed, gives me a kiss, says goodbye. I said, have fun at yoga. And I rolled over and went back to sleep. And my alarm goes off at, I don't know, about 7 o'clock. I come downstairs to make some breakfast. And about 7:10, as was our custom, I shot her a text. And I said, hey, how was yoga? To which I got no response. And I thought, you know, not a big deal. While she wasn't a huge talker, she was an incredible listener. And as a result, would often get sucked into some long, drawn out conversations with her students. So I went about my morning and, you know, had breakfast, sent her another note maybe an hour later, still no response, no big deal. She had five kids, maybe she got tied up, hopped in my car to head downtown to my next meeting, tried calling, phone rang and rang and rang and rang, eventually got voicemail. And again, so now I'm feeling like, yeah, this is a little out of character. And, you know, those stories that you start telling yourself, did I do something stupid? Like, did I piss her off? Is she upset? Why is she not responding? And of course, it's like, well, no, we had an incredible evening together. Like, that's just stupid. And then, you know, your mind jumps to, I hope everything's okay. And, you know, so you start to rationalize. So I went down, did my meeting, came back to my office for about 11 o'clock, still no response. I had another meeting. We finished up. We went across the street to go for lunch. And, you know, by this time, my gut is just in knots because I'm like, this is way out of character now. And I'm worried. I'm really concerned. And so I shot her a note. I said, hey, let me know you're okay. I'm starting to get a little bit worried about you. And as we walked into the restaurant, my phone rang and it was a blocked number. And I answered it. And the voice on the other end of the line said, is this Mike Cameron? I said, yes. He said, this is Constable so-and-so. And I don't remember his name, but my heart just sank. And I practically screamed into the phone. I said, is she okay? He says, where are you? I said, is she okay? He says, where are you? We're at your house. We're coming to you. And again, my heart just sank. And I turned and I walked out of the restaurant. I don't think I said even two words to my guests. And I stood at the side of the curb, you know, for what felt like an eternity, but it was probably only 5 or 6 minutes. My house wasn't far from where we were. And this unmarked police car pulls up across the street and this big badass burly looking cop gets out and starts walking towards me. So I walk across the street and he meets me halfway across the street. And after identifying who I was, he said those three words that would ultimately change my life. He looked at me and he said, Carissa is dead. Shot and killed by an ex-boyfriend who subsequently took his own life. And it was just this moment of, this can't be real. Like this cannot be real. This doesn't happen to me. This doesn't happen in real life. This doesn't happen to a middle-aged white dude in suburbia. Like this doesn't happen. But you know, it was all too real. And I had, you know, so many people surround me and, you know, they know I'm a guy that likes to make shit happen and get things done. And so I had a lot of people that wanted me to go after the justice system, which surely let her down. You know, she had a restraining order. She'd done all the right things from a legal standpoint, none of which obviously helped. And I just thought, you know, how do we build a better restraining order is really akin to putting a Band-Aid on a ruptured jugular. So I really started looking at, okay, how can I best impact the world? Given my skill set, given my experience, where can I best make an impact? And that's when I went back to, you know, those learnings back from when I was 18. We make decisions based on emotion. this was a dude that made a decision with very permanent consequences based on a very temporary emotion. And as men, we're actively discouraged from exploring our emotions. And again, this is what I teach in leadership. You know, you want to be a better leader, you want to be a better salesperson. It's about understanding those underlying emotions that drive those decisions we make. Because if we don't understand those, we have zero opportunity of living a fully awakened and purposeful existence. So that's what led to the TED Talk. And that was essentially the message in the TEDx. I mean, my message is we need to give men permission to feel. You know, the reason I'm passionate about teaching men, and in particular leaders, to be more emotionally connected is partly because emotionally connected men don't fucking kill people. Like, emotionally connected men make better leaders. They make better partners. They make better fathers. They make happier human beings, and they live richer lives. And, you know, you look at the statistics, 3/4 of all suicides are men. The vast majority of violent crimes are committed by men. Men everywhere are hurting. And if we could solve that problem, Alex, dude, so many of the other problems go away. And like I said, for me, because I've got that business background, it starts at the highest level. You know, I mean, I do a lot of grassroots stuff. I've done some work with the local Edmonton Police Service here, working with youth. So, you know, that's one arena. But for me, I look at who has the influence in the world, and where can we best serve that? And again, I look at how do we, you know, I look at sort of what I would call the power of privilege. You know, not to take away that I'm a privileged white dude, but I've got a responsibility to do something with that. And my hope is that we can learn as a society that that doesn't have to be onerous. And in fact, that can be advantageous. And so all of these things are interconnected. So sometimes I kind of Trojan horse this message in because, again, the skills, the knowledge, the awareness that make better people better human beings also make them better performers. And, you know, usually, especially for guys, that's what we like to hear about. I don't necessarily want to hear about how do I be a better human being. I want to hear about how do I perform better, because that's what's important to me. So sometimes it becomes a bit of a Trojan horse thing because the two are very connected.
Right. And I mean, you know, firstly, you know, I think everyone listening is probably thinking the same thing, which is, you know, everyone's so, you know, sorry that sort of happened to obviously you, and, you know, everyone's kind of families involved in that situation. And it's something where, you know, you've been an entrepreneur, someone, as you say, has been very, very successful. And this has come completely at a random, seemingly. And it's something that's outside of your control. And you know, lots of people wouldn't have been able to deal with that in the way that you have, which is very, very positive. Just looking at that kind of, you know, decision to turn something which was so terrible, so unexpected, into, you know, the level of sort of positivity and you know, global benefit, really, in what you're doing. Did you sort of go through some dark periods with that, and then you had to sort of talk yourself around to what you're doing now, or is it something that you just instinctively sort of went towards turning it into a positive?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I instinctively went there. There's certainly some dark points, but there was a moment, and it was actually the day after she was killed, that a friend of mine, a yogi from Montreal, so halfway across the country, he sent me a link to an article. Do you know who Ram Dass is? Ram Dass is an American spiritual leader from the 1970s. So he wrote, it's called A Letter to Rachel. And Rachel was a young girl who had been murdered. So Ram Dass wrote this letter to her parents. And my friend Eric sent me this letter the day after Carissa was killed. And he said, I don't know if this will help you. He said, but I've read this dozens of times and I find great comfort in this letter. And when I read the letter, like I get goosebumps describing it because that letter absolutely changed my life. So there were three things. It's worth reading. It's like five paragraphs. It's not a long letter, but there were three things that he talked about in there. The first thing he said is anyone strong enough to remain conscious through such teachings as you are receiving? Probably very few. And you can see that still impacts me today. As I say that, I choke up. Is anyone strong enough to remain conscious through the such teachings as you are receiving? And I, in that moment, I thought, you know what? Like, this is what Chris and I did together. We learned, we shared podcasts, we read, we compared notes. We had these conversations about human potential, about growth. And I just thought, who am I to squander this opportunity? And I committed to remain conscious through the teachings that I was receiving. And the second one was, he said, our rational minds will never understand what has happened, but our hearts, if we keep them open, will find their own intuitive way. And again, I can't tell you how many times I said, why her, why now, why? And there's just, you know, there's no answer to that. And we can get lost in trying to find the why. But that was, to me, just a reminder that our hearts, if we keep them open, will find their own intuitive way. And the last piece, and maybe most important, was now is the time to let your grief find expression. No false strength. And that, I really think, Alex, is what those three pieces are, what have allowed me to move this from pain to purpose. And it doesn't mean that the pain isn't there, but it means that I sit with it. And again, it's everything I've taught in the context of leadership and sales, being aware of those feelings, noticing how they come up, being able to acknowledge them and not brush them aside and refuse them and say, I'm a dude, I got to be strong, I shouldn't feel sad, it's a horrible thing, but suck it up, Mike. Like, that's just such crap. And so I really, and again, to like, who am I? You know, the response is always, I'm so sorry for your loss. And yeah, it was absolutely a horrific thing. But I can't change that thing. So who am I to squander this opportunity that she's given me? You know, I could have thrown myself into a bottle. I could have thrown myself into work. I could have become even more of a workaholic than I was to just numb out that feeling. But that wouldn't do her justice. That wouldn't serve the world. And, you know, like I said, I was already on a bit of a path of how do I move from success to significance? And so that really solidified it for me. So again, I don't know that it was instinctual, but it was, and I, like, for the longest time, I couldn't say this without just absolutely falling apart. But I really believe that those 20 or 25 years of experiences that I've had prepared me for this and had given me the tools to navigate and not only navigate, but to turn this into something much bigger than her and much bigger than myself. And that's what I feel compelled to do. And like I said, I get excited working with leaders that have an inspired vision, that want to make an impact, that want to use that power of privilege. And how do we do that? Because there's so many good men out there. And the problem is, you know, so often, and I was one of them, right? Like I went to bed on October 1st, a good man. I wasn't part of the problem, but I also wasn't part of the solution. And I had a choice to make.
And why do you think it is that, you know, men have such trouble, you know, connecting, sort of expressing their emotions, and then, you know, these things happen where it's all bottled up, and you know, events like you described come, you know, seemingly out of nowhere?
I mean, there's just so much societal conditioning as to who we are supposed to be. And then when that doesn't jive with who we are, it becomes this dissonance that we have to fight. And it becomes very problematic. It's funny, when I first started having these conversations, and I would say, you know, from the time that we were in diapers as men, we're taught to bury, avoid, suppress. And my mom got quite upset with me. She's like, we never taught you that. We always allowed you to be expressive. And I said, you know what, Mom, you're right. Because I grew up in a very loving, very kind family. My parents were wonderful. But in spite of that, I mean, again, I think back to some of my early business, the guy I played hockey with, right? Like there was this machismo that we had to live up to. There was this, you know, who's doing the $1 million deal today? Who's doing the $20 million deal today? Who's doing the $250 million deal today? Like it was just this competitive. And again, not that there's anything wrong with competition, but there's a fine line between, again, being that authentic self and trying to prove to the world that you are what you think they want you to be. And I think that's where we run into problem. And it's just, you know, you've got corporations spending billions of dollars in marketing to tell you that you're not enough. You're not worthy. You need Axe body spray because you're not good enough as is, right? Like, so there's all these messages that we continue to get bombarded with. And then, you know, culturally, you know, for centuries, we've been brought up that way. And so it's a really difficult cycle to break. So this is where I come at it from a performance standpoint, because again, if you look at IQ versus EQ, I would take EQ all day long over IQ because that's what really drives performance. And again, if you want to get deep into performance, you know, again, I run ultra marathons, right? So it's not about how physically fit I am. It's about how mentally and emotionally tough I am, that when the shit hits the fan and it, you know, I'm 90 miles into a 100-mile race, taking that next step is hard. So it's not what I know, because I know all the things, right? I know all the theory about what I'm supposed to do at that point, but it's about having the practice of embracing that suck and really being able to step into that.
And before we sort of jump into, you know, the ultra marathons and some of the, you know, the emotional pieces around kind of sales and leadership and things, but be really interested to kind of get your opinion on, you know, how organizations can really optimize and improve, you know, particularly kind of male mental health and things like that in the workforce.
Yes.
And you know, you've come from a high performing sales background and are an entrepreneur. I've come from, you know, surgery, which is very male predominated, you know, very kind of masculine in everything, and you know, failure is almost not allowed, and equally in sort of, you know, tech startups and things like that, especially like on the background of the pandemic and you know, just a huge rise in mental health problems in general. How do you think people can even start sort of tackling this?
Create the space. So that is the number one thing. Is create the space to have the conversation, and maybe more importantly, not just have the conversation, but express the emotion, express the feelings, because we can have the intellectual conversations all day long. So what I do often is we create small group environments where, like, maybe a leadership team would get together. And what I've found that I'm really good at is creating that safe space. So I use the acronym SOAR. I'm a big fan of frameworks. So it's slow down, open up, accept, and reconnect. So when we can create that space where we can soar, again, it's just about practicing that pause, taking a breath, opening up. And the open up is twofold. One, to self. So really open up and what's there. Again, if you're in a high performance situation and you're terrified and you've got that imposter syndrome thing going on, you're likely just going to bury the crap out of it because you don't want to admit it's there, because I'm a high performer. I'm not supposed to feel this way, but you do. And everybody does. So opening up to self and acknowledging that that's there. And the second piece is opening up to others. So when we can do this in a safe environment, and especially with high-performing leaders, it's phenomenal to hear that, you know what, Alex? Like, dude, I struggle with that imposter syndrome too. Like, who am I to be giving you advice on sales? Sure, I've been successful, but man, look at you, or look at Joe down the street, or whatever. And when we start to open up and share, and we find that we're not alone. And the weight that that can take off, you know, I think most of us guys, when we get up in the morning, we put on that metaphorical armor, and it's like we're carrying a weight vest all day, every day. And, you know, I often ask, you know, I use that analogy and I ask guys, so when do you lose that? And sometimes it's, you know, like I play guitar. So yeah, when I play guitar, man, that weight vest is gone. That armor is gone. I said, that's awesome. What does that feel like? So we'll dive into and we'll explore that. And then I say, okay, so what do you do when you're done playing guitar? Yeah, you know what? I armor back up again. I put the weight vest back on and I go back out. And, you know, again, using that analogy, think about how freeing would it be if you could walk around 10 or 20 pounds lighter every single day. Like, how much better could you perform? How much better could you show up for your team if you weren't worried about some of those things or that tape playing in the background that maybe you're not even aware of? So, sorry, that's a long-winded answer to your short question.
No, it's absolutely fantastic. And I mean, I think, you know, one thing I sort of really want to dive into, particularly around what you know, you've just been sort of expanding there, is, you know, if we really sort of focus down on things like rejection and failure, especially in kind of males. And I recently wrote a sort of blog article on this exact topic. You know, often if people are rejected, whether it's by a, you know, a female, or whether it's, you know, they didn't get a job that they were going for in terms of promotion, for whatever reason, some people seem to internalize that more than others, and really take it as a hit to their whole, you know, ego and self-worth. How, you know, if you're kind of working with leaders and sort of coaching them, how do you sort of broach that and make sure that they're kind of reflecting and learning and moving on from mistakes and not taking it in that kind of very, very personal way?
Right. Well, again, that's that practice of self-compassion. And it is a practice. And I think that's the important thing to learn. So the first piece is that awareness piece. You know, Eckhart Tolle talks about with awareness comes choice. And the problem for most is we're not even aware of these things. And then what can happen, you know, especially for guys, I mean, we're allowed to have two emotions, anger and sports, right? So what often happens is something like that happens. We get rejected, we fail, we don't get a job. So we're sad, we're disappointed, we feel bad about ourselves. And then it becomes, well, I'm a dude, I'm strong, I'm tough, I shouldn't feel bad about myself. So then you get mad about feeling bad about what happened. And that's that A in SOAR, the acceptance piece. Accept the fact that you're sad, you're disappointed, you're hurt. But the problem is often we don't do that. And so then that secondary emotion, which is anger, and anger is often sadness masked, that comes out. And then we start making stupid decisions because we're doing it based on anger, not acknowledging that, you know what, this isn't really anger, this is hurt. So rather than trying to deal with the anger, let's go a layer deeper and deal with the hurt, because that's what actually drives performance. So again, coming back to the whole sort of chain of events, if our emotions drive our decisions drive our behaviors ultimately drive our results. Oftentimes what we try and do is we try and brute force change the behaviors. I'm not going to eat that donut. I'm not going to eat that donut. I'm not going to eat that donut. And I can do that for a week. But if I don't address the underlying reason that I eat that donut, because I feel crappy about myself. So that's why I eat the donut, because I feel crappy about myself, because, and again, you can go many, many, many layers deep. But if you don't address that, You know, I can will myself not to eat that donut for a week, for a month, maybe even for a year. But at some point, if I don't address the underlying reason I'm eating that donut, I'm going to go back to eating the donut.
Right.
And I think that is the critical piece when we're talking about performance, is you can't just try and change the behavior. You've got to look at what is driving the behavior and get to that root cause.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really good sort of focus down on why, you know, coaching is so kind of important in any organization and having kind of a coaching culture, because for each individual, you've really got to sort of dive in and get them looking introspectively and questioning what are some of those driving forces that are sort of affecting their emotions. And then, as you say, their behaviors. In terms of, you know, your experience of using emotion in things like sales and leadership, can you speak, you know, specifically just to that and how any organization can sort of start integrating this kind of practically to sort of transform their workforce?
Yeah, I mean, again, from a sales standpoint, it really is about recognizing what the customers buy. The customers don't buy the product. They buy the feeling that ultimately the product is going to give them. So how do you demonstrate that? And, you know, you can see that in tons of marketing campaigns. I mean, some of the best marketing campaigns are the ones that do the most work to tap in deep to that. And again, from a leadership standpoint, you know, I'm a big fan of Kuz's and Posner's Leadership Challenge. So the 5 exemplary practices of leadership, model the way, inspire a shared vision, encourage others, encourage the heart, enable others to act, and challenge the process. So that inspire a shared vision. I mean, again, it's about that emotional connection to the vision. And so how do we best create that emotional connection? I'm searching for an analogy, and I can't grab one right now, or an example off the top of my head. But it really is about, again, it's not focusing on the thing. It's about focusing on the feeling that's going to get us to the thing. And where can we get excited about that? And, you know, and that comes back to, you know, empathy and leadership, which has historically been thought of as, oh, that's weak. That's weak. Forget that. Suck it up. Let's go. We've got numbers to hit. We've got shareholders to please. You know, so the example there, if you've got an employee that's underperforming, so there's 2 ways you can approach that, right? Hey, Alex, I want you to come into my office for a minute. Look, dude, what the hell is going on? You're dropping the ball. You're shitting the bed. If you don't pick up your socks, dude, you're out. Like, I got shareholders to answer to. I need you to pick up your socks. Versus, hey, Alex, look, I know you're better than this. Like, I know you're a better performer. So tell me what's going on in your life. Like, I'm gathering something must be going on because your results just aren't here right now. So now you as an employee, which of those 2 are you going to respond better to, right? If you're dreading going into work every day because Mike's going to rip your head off if you don't perform, A, you're going to feel terrible. B, you're not going to perform. Whereas if you go in the other way and say, hey, you know what? I know Mike's got my back. You know, maybe there is something going on. Maybe you're going through a divorce. Maybe you're having some challenges at home. But if you know that, okay, Mike's got my back, I don't have to hide this stuff. I can just live this, but also focus on the performance at work, what I need to do. And he's going to be there. If I'm struggling because my brain is elsewhere, I can just say, hey, Mike, look, you know, I know this stuff, but right now I'm struggling. What do you think? Boom, problem solved.
Yeah, I think it's so important to have a real, you know, understanding whether you're a, you know, sales leader or a team leader or a manager or the CEO of a company. Really, you know, spend time looking at what is happening with your employees on a personal level. Sometimes that can be very, very difficult, but building in that kind of coaching culture where you're either as a CEO sort of getting feedback from your team leads, your managers, or you're doing sort of one-to-one sessions yourself, depending on your company size, and bringing that personal element, I think is just so, so important for folks.
Yeah, well, I love what you said, the coaching culture. And that culture piece is so important. You know, and I do a lot of work in the realm of violence prevention. So, you know, I get asked to share my story and talk about in that context. And, you know, always we'll talk about organizations that have anti-bullying, anti-harassment policies. They'll have all of the policies in place. But I think it was the book, The Culture Code, he talked about culture eats policy for breakfast. So I don't care how much policy you've got in place. If your culture is not conducive to that, policy isn't going to make a lick of difference. So, yeah. So I love that. That coaching culture is very powerful.
100%. And I mean, moving back towards yourself, I mean, you've had a kind of amazing personal journey. And as you sort of mentioned earlier, I've got a huge amount of respect and admiration for anyone who does any kind of sporting event and puts them through the hell of things like kind of an ultra marathon or triathlon and things. I've done two marathons in the past, New York and Tokyo, just training for those was bad enough. But can you speak to your own kind of like mindset and how you sort of get yourself through those challenges, amongst doing all this other amazing stuff?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, I mean, it's not even amongst doing all this other amazing stuff. It's part of doing all this other amazing stuff. And I think that's important. Like, this isn't a sideline. This is part of the process. So for me, again, when I got divorced in 2012, I really kind of needed a distraction. So my brother and sister had gotten into triathlon. They were going to do Ironman the next year. And I said, all right, sign me up. And I had young kids, and my sister, I remember her texting me like, are you sure, dude? Like, really? And I'm like, yep, let's do it. So I did my first Ironman in 2013, and I was in the best shape of my life, and I just didn't want to let that go. So I continued to follow that up. Now I've got July 10th. So coming up right away, I've got a 100-mile ultra marathon down in the Crow's Nest Pass. So it's 21,000 feet of elevation over 100 miles. I've got 30 hours to finish it. But for me, the reason I do those is two words: controlled adversity. So it's an opportunity to practice. So much like what happened to me when Carissa was killed, it was an opportunity to practice that resilience. And so many of us squander those opportunities because they're hard. And sometimes there's easier ways, or seemingly easier ways. Again, bury yourself in a bottle, bury yourself in work, find some other distraction. So for me, the performance sports, the ultra marathons, the 24-hour races, things like that, it is really about putting myself in circumstances where there's that controlled adversity. I mean, the reality is there's medics on staff, there's search and rescue. If I get lost on the mountain, somebody's going to find me. I mean, obviously, that wasn't the case for there was those 21 runners in China that died. So, I mean, you're certainly putting yourself in harm's way. But that all translates back to business, back to life, back to my relationships. And it really is just about taking yourself to that point where it sucks. So one of my favorite athletes is a fellow by the name of Chris McCormick. He's a Ironman champion. I think he's won the world championship twice. He's won maybe a dozen or more races. And when I first got into triathlon, I read an article that he wrote called Embrace the Suck. And he talked about when he moved from short course triathlon to long course triathlon, that there was no amount of training that was going to allow him to avoid the suck that comes with those endurance events. And so he had to shift his mindset. In the short course ones, he just train so that it didn't suck and he performed well. But in the long course ones, there was no amount of training that was going to get him to a point where at some point in the race, it didn't suck. So rather than training to avoid the suck, he would start to train to embrace the suck. And that holds so true in life and in business in particular, right? Like in business, we train to avoid the suck as much as possible. But the reality is, as you well know, as an entrepreneur, at some point, life is going to suck. Your girlfriend gets murdered. Nothing I could have done to avoid that, to prepare for that. So rather than training to avoid, it's about training to embrace. And so for me, that's what endurance sport is all about. It's the opportunity, because I know I am going to get to that space where it sucks and my heart just wants to quit. My head wants to quit. And I just have to say, you know what? Give it an hour, see where you're at. And I do that sometimes for 20 hours on repeat. Okay, give it an hour, see where you're at. Give it an hour, see where you're at. Or sometimes it's give it 5 minutes and see where you're at. Take 10 steps, you know, at the beginning. And that's the other thing. So again, in the business context, if you're thinking about building a multi-million or multi-billion dollar business, I mean, that's a big task. And that's, oh my God, that's overwhelming. Running 100 miles, that's overwhelming. If I stand at that start line and think about, holy crap, Alex, I got to run 100 miles. I can't run 100 miles. Like, that becomes overwhelming. But that first aid station, that is 10 miles in. I can run 10 miles all day long. So that's all I got to do right now. I got to run 10 miles. And then the next aid station, another 10 miles. I can run 10 miles. I can do that all day long. And then the next one and the next one. And then, you know, by the time you get to 70 or 80 miles, you're not thinking in 10 mile increments anymore. Now it's like, okay, I just need to go another mile. And then, okay, I can do that all day long. And then another mile. And then, you know, when you get to 90 miles, now you're starting to think in steps. I just need to take another 20 steps. I can do that. I can always do 20 steps. Not a big deal. And then you just do it 20 steps at a time, or you narrow your focus. Like, I just need to take 2 steps. I just need to keep moving forward, relentless forward progress. And that translates for me so well into life. You just narrow your focus to as narrow as it needs to be in the moment to get you through.
It's an amazing example. I actually wrote an article a few weeks ago for Entrepreneur Magazine on sort of how to get started and how to overcome things like procrastination. And one of the things I touched on was having that kind of what I called a macro mission. So, you know, whether it's doing an ultra marathon and it's you kind of, you know, conquering your own ability to kind of finish, or whether it's just sort of, you know, getting started at something, but then breaking that huge goal down into what I termed a kind of like micro mission. And that enables you to get like quick wins, to reward yourself, to be kind to yourself as you're doing it. In my opinion, like the most important part of you know, anything you do is, yes, to challenge yourself, because that's kind of how you grow and how you learn. But it's also to enjoy the journey as you're going on it. And I think, you know, your whole story is so amazing to me, because as you said at the top of the conversation, you already had some of these skills kind of embedded in you from your sort of knowledge of kind of emotion and how that affects people. So your kind of resilience, although, you know, these things have happened, your mind is obviously kind of immediately gone to, you know, what to do and how to respond positively, which I think is another great reason why, you know, every single individual and every single business needs to get, you know, their employees kind of trained up and understanding how to react when things go wrong, because things will go wrong. That's part of life, as we've seen over the last kind of 18 months or so. But it's very much how you respond, how you get up and how you, you know, approach life after that event, which is kind of what defines you and what helps you to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I love that what you talked about, the micro steps and celebrating those wins, you know, getting that little dopamine hit at getting to that first aid station, like high five and everybody at the aids, woohoo, we made it, only 90 more miles to go. You know, we don't say that, but we just celebrating that first win. I made it to the first aid station, woohoo. And so many of us struggle to celebrate the wins. Yeah, but I still got 90 miles to go. Who cares? Celebrate the win. So I think that's a really, really powerful and important piece. Because it builds momentum and you can keep going from that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think as we sort of start to wrap things up, I mean, you've already mentioned a couple of people who sort of inspire you, but I'd be really interested to know, you know, your own human performance hero who, you know, has really kind of influenced you on your journey.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this, and I think I've got to go. You know, there's lots of sort of celebrity types that I could choose, but there's a fellow by the name of Yousry Bissada. And Yousry is the CEO of Home Capital here. It's like, I don't know, $2.5 billion finance company. So pretty powerful position. But Yousry, I have known for, I don't know, close to 15, maybe even 20 years now. And Yousry is the epitome of the nice guy. And so to see a guy like that, because, you know, there can be this tendency to feel like the nice guys finish last. Yousry leads with compassion, leads with care, but gets stuff done. Like, again, care and compassion doesn't mean you don't have boundaries, doesn't mean you don't have targets, doesn't mean there aren't expectations. So Yousry is a guy that I look to when I look at leadership and I look at a role model. So I think Yousry would be the guy I would choose.
That's an awesome example. And I think really, really on point with the whole conversation, actually. Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure. And, you know, if anyone wants to kind of get in touch with you, where can they go to find out a little bit more?
Yeah, my website is mikecameron.ca. So that's the best place to catch me. And if you want to shoot me an email, mike@mikecameron.ca. I love to connect. Connection is my middle name. So I'm always game for a virtual coffee or a conversation like this. I absolutely love having these conversations. So thank you for having me on.
Awesome. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'll just again plug your TED talk, which I think is absolutely fantastic. And you know, everyone should really look at. And it's, you know, the whole story is sort of so inspiring. And it's, you know, you and really your response, which is, what sort of has defined you as an individual, which is amazing. And, you know, best of luck at the ultra marathon. And better you than me.
I'm so excited. Like, you know, last year we didn't run, and my partner, my girlfriend now, she crews me. So it's really a team effort, because, you know, getting through that kind of thing, I need somebody shoving food in my face when I get to the checkpoints and making sure my feet are in good shape and all that kind of stuff. So I'm really excited to do this with her.
Awesome. Well, I hope you have a lot of fun with it. And, thanks again for coming on this week. It's been amazing.